Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome with us this morning. Doesn't look like enough of them are here, but I'm going to announce it anyway. We'll see. We're delighted to welcome West High School students. Are they here? They're not here. When they come, a large group comes. That's right. Okay. But we do have with us Wisconsin Lutheran High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. The program is called Court with Class. Students are invited from all over the state to join us for an oral argument, and if they come, they are sent briefs. They may do some activities related to the case, and at noon they will meet with a justice of this court. Everyone's invited to the noon session with the justice. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the cases. With those remarks made, I will introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you'll meet at lunch today. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robensack. Now, if anyone would like a synopsis of the case we're about to hear, just raise your hand. The marshal has some summaries of the case. Oh, dear. We're in for a long hour.
I've been waiting for one of us to do that.
I have it myself. All right. We now remove our first case, 03AP 2802CR, State versus David J. Roberson. Representing Mr. Roberson is Assistant State Public Defender Richard D. Martin. Mr. Martin.
May it please the Court, I am Richard Martin, and I do represent Mr. Roberson in this case, the defendant, appellant, petitioner. My oldest son says I have a tendency to over-explain things, and to explain why that's grossly exaggerated would take about half an hour, so I won't. But this brief may over-explain things a bit, and all I would say in his defense is the procedural posture of this case is so strange. First, there was no suppression motion filed. Secondly, the post-conviction motion was denied without a hearing. Third, a unanimous panel of the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded for an evidentiary hearing. Fourth, Mr. O'Brien moved for reconsideration successfully. Fifth, we had supplemental briefing. Sixth, that same panel unanimously reversed itself and held that Mr. Roberson was not entitled to a hearing. And I had to try to explain all that in this brief, but I think that sometimes at points you lose the forest for the trees. The state's brief reminds me, and I never thought I'd quote Walter Mondale ever, but reminds me of Walter Mondale's jab to Gary Hart, where is the beef? Where is the detailed description of Mr. Roberson that gave the police probable cause to arrest him in his home without a warrant? There is no detailed description either in the state's brief or in this record. The state's argument, at least today in this court, and we'll be talking about whether there's a need for a hearing, and I think I'll be returning to the theme that we have an undeveloped record here. We're trying to pull things out of a record where there was no suppression hearing. There was no litigation of the facts of the entry and the seizure and the arrest. But the state's argument, at least today in this court, depends upon the proposition that Milwaukee police officers who barged into Ms. Roberson's home had probable cause to arrest David Roberson for his involvement in a drug sale that took place just blocks from his home and just minutes before. Repeatedly, the state's brief claims there was probable cause to arrest David Roberson because of the, quote, detailed description, which through a mystical invocation of the collective knowledge doctrine infused, and this is on page 19 of the state's brief, infused the arresting officers with probable cause. But again, there is no recitation of that, quote, unquote, detailed description. And that argument the state puts forth in this court convinced the Court of Appeals, I'm just going to read, I think, one line from the Court of Appeals decision, page 22, paragraph 22, in the new public domain manner. Paragraph 22, the court said, and this is the Roberson 2 decision, the one where Mr. Roberson lost. Here, the arresting officers were in close communication with Detective Wagner and Officer Terrell, period. The facts known to Detective Wagner and Officer Terrell provided the arresting officers with probable cause to arrest Roberson. But the collective knowledge doctrine requires that the information that's within the collective knowledge of the police be communicated to the arresting officers. And there is one paragraph. As complicated as this case is, you can resolve it, for the most part, from one page, one paragraph. It's record 29, page 89, lines 11 through 17. This is Officer Mitchell Ward. He was one of the officers who went into the home. He was not on the, quote, redo team, which is a six-person drug team that was doing the surveillance and the buy and the whole thing. He was called in to help. And he testified, and I'll quote him very briefly. He testified when he came into the room. Mr. Roberson was sitting on that bed. He was dressed in that colorful sweater that he has on, blue jeans, and he was holding a small child. At that point, he matched the description I was given as the person who sold the narcotics, and I asked him to stand up and come with me. That's record 29, page 89, lines 11 through 17. Nowhere in Officer Ward's testimony does he tell us what that description was that Mr. Roberson matched. It just isn't there. And so there's nothing here to show that any description was conveyed to Officer Ward. If you look at the record, what did Terrell and Wagner say about Mr. Roberson's appearance? They said he was a black male, had wavy hair, was wearing blue jeans, a gray coat with a stripe on it, and light to medium complexion. That's it. No height, no weight, no age, no distinguishing features whatsoever. None. Interestingly, when he's arrested, he's wearing a two-tone green and orange sweater and orange shoes. Things that might be worth pointing out if you wanted to give a detailed description of someone. Not in this, they're not in the Wagner-Terrell description that they had before and after the controlled buy. And I want to emphasize, there is nothing in this record that shows any description of Mr. Roberson was conveyed to any officers who went to the house.
Okay. Your brief asks for a remand to the trial court with instructions to grant an evidentiary hearing concerning suppression of the identification and whether defense counsel was ineffective. So if there were a remand, what would the trial court decide? Ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, it has to decide both. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Because ineffective assistance, you'd have to show that it fell below the standard and that it was prejudicial. To show prejudicial on ineffective assistance of counsel, you then would have to show that that the identification had to be suppressed. Is that right?
Exactly right.
Okay. So ultimately you get to whether the identification had to be suppressed.
Correct.
Is that the identification in the house, or is it the identification in the at trial, or both?
First of all, it's the seizure in the house, because there is no identification in the house, and I want to emphasize that. There was no identification in the house. What you had was a general rousting of all the occupants, literally four or five black males summoned to the porch, and then they didn't find the person they thought they were looking for, then they go upstairs and they roust Mr. Roberson. There was no identification in the house. There was an identification on the street afterwards, and I would argue that has to be suppressed, at least insofar as contemporaneous with their entry. Now then the state can come back and show an independent source for the identification, and there's all there could be a lineup, there could be other ways they could say that we had enough. The problem, again, is the record's undeveloped. We don't know what other description Terrell or Wagner may have had. But that would have to be established at the post-conviction hearing.
So do you have to show the seizure in the house was invalid?
At the post-conviction hearing?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so you have to show that your job would be, so the seizure in the house invalid and the ID invalid. Okay. Why is the seizure in the house invalid?
Well, the Founding Fathers had this idea that a person's home is their castle and that the police can't come in unless the magistrate's authorized it. This Court and the Supreme Court and many courts have said warrantless entries of the home are presumptively unconstitutional. This is not a new doctrine or a novel one.
That's patent. Okay. No exceptions to that rule?
There are many exceptions. There's the exigent circumstances. There's hot pursuit. There's consent. There's lots of them. And I argue that
What about here? You talk about quickly exigent circumstances. This basically was where the police were watching for a drug buy. They had communication back and forth. They knew that there were five people involved.
No.
They saw the buy. Now, let me just start up. They saw the buy. They saw where the people went. They were watching them. And then they went up to the house. You're saying this didn't fall in exigent or hot pursuit?
Well, the reason I started up, there were only two people involved in the drug buy on the street, in the car, and a third person who's not involved.
Let's say they saw five people going to the house.
They didn't. They saw two people going to the house.
Okay.
The record's very clear. They had the car in more or less continuous observation, and they testified that they saw two people later identified as my client and Curdrell Wright go into the house. But it's not exigent circumstances for a number of reasons. First of all, the police can't create the exigency. They were not in hot pursuit. These people were not fleeing. There had been no sirens or lights activated. The police were staying back, trying to stay out of sight until they could summon non-undercover police to come and do their dirty work and go into the house. The police officer's own conduct shows this isn't exigent circumstances. If it was true exigent circumstances, you wouldn't go up, knock on the door, and say, Ms. Roberson, could you ask everybody to come outside and put them on the porch so we can have this display of possible perpetrators and we can observe them from a distance? And allow anybody else in the house to do whatever they want, destroying evidence, hide, arm themselves, all the things that exigent circumstances talks about. This reminds me of when you play hide and seek with your kid and you say, I'm going to give you 30 seconds, and you count really loud. I mean, anybody who's upstairs in the house or in the basement of the house knows the police are out there. They become aware of the house is surrounded. But if several minutes go by before they go up into the house, and they wouldn't have if they had found who they were looking for in the first floor. So this is not exigent circumstances by any stretch.
Do you have to have fleeing in order to do hot pursuit?
Yes, that's what the case law says. It has to be hot pursuit. It has to be immediate. It has to be from the scene of the crime to the house. And that's discussed, I think, both in my brief in this court. I know it's discussed a bit more extensively in the appeals court briefs because the state threw up every possible exception in the Court of Appeals. They argued both exigent circumstances, which means we have to act fast, and inevitable discovery, which means we would have found the stuff anyway. And they don't both.
Go ahead. Excuse me.
Why isn't this case, in terms of hot pursuit, covered by the Richter decision, State versus Richter, Marinette County?
I'm sorry.
Why is this case not covered by State versus Richter out of Marinette County?
I honestly remember the facts of Richter, but I know that hot pursuit requires that the suspects be aware they're being pursued, and it has to be from the scene of the crime right to the house, and the record is very clear. The police, A, weren't pursuing them, B, were trying to keep them in sight but stay out of their sight, and there was an undercover officer who made this buy. He testified that he didn't immediately arrest the person who sold him the drugs because he wanted to maintain his undercover status.
But where do you get the idea that the defendant has to know that he's being pursued?
Well, that's what the case law says. It has to be from the scene. It has to be immediate. I can give you some sites if I pull out my Court of Appeals brief. I don't think all of it's in the Supreme Court brief because they haven't argued hot pursuit in this court. They argued it in the Court of Appeals, or at least hinted at it.
But wouldn't you say that Detective Wagner had his eyes on that gray cutlass and watched the cutlass from the scene of the offense I'm not sure. He didn't watch at the actual control by, but he's watching that couple immediately before and immediately after, and he watches it go to the house. He watches two people get out and look around and then run into the house. Why isn't that an immediate and continuous pursuit from the scene of the crime?
Because both Wagner and Terrell are doing the antithesis of a pursuit. They're staying back. They're trying to be in the background. They're calling uniformed officers and people even outside their team to go in and do the search and the arrest for whatever reasons. And again, the record isn't developed. We don't know exactly. It's not even clear where Wagner and Terrell were when the suspects were brought out of the house. But they're holding back. They're staying back. If I can, I think I can give you a better answer on the pursuit thing from, I'm sorry. One of the court of appeals briefs is discussed a bit more. It didn't seem to be an issue in this court, and I'd be glad to follow up with a letter if you want. But as I understand, hot pursuit has to be a true pursuit where the police are chasing someone, the person knows they're being chased, they're fleeing into a house or fleeing into the woods, and it's a continuous chase. This was not a chase. This was the police surveilling, doing the controlled by, getting on the radio, keeping their identity secret, keeping the fact that they're police officers secret, and calling in other people to do what happened. And yes, there's testimony that these suspects were concerned the police might be around. There's testimony they looked around before they went in the house to see if the police were around. But there's not testimony that anybody went fast or drove fast or ran. This is just not a pursuit.
Mr. Martin, how do you get around the exception created to the attenuation rule created in New York versus Harris?
Well, first of all, New York versus Harris talks about arrests that are based upon probable cause. There was not probable cause to arrest this person. I conceded, I think, in response to the Chief Justice's question, or maybe Justice Wilcox, that it's conceivable the state may be able to show an independent source of these identifications after a suppression hearing, after there's been proper fact-finding, after the state proves up what their bases were for identification and whether they're independent. The interesting thing about this case is, despite this rousting of the house, the police found no drugs, they found no guns, they found no cell phones, no pagers, no drugs whatsoever, no scales. So there's nothing really to suppress except for the fact that the defendant's in his home. That was what was so critical here, and it was testimony at trial. He was right where you'd expect the suspect to be, right at the time you'd expect the suspect to be, and that's what has to be suppressed. But there's no confession, the attenuation effects, there's no drugs, the attenuation effects. I will concede after a proper suppression hearing the state may be able to show an independent basis for the identification. But they still can't bring in the fact that Mr. Roberson was in his home at the time and place.
Maybe I didn't. Does your argument hinge upon the fact that you think there's no probable cause? What if this court were to find, and I guess this is just my question, what if the court were to find that there was sufficient probable cause here? Would this case then be controlled by Harris?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure when you say probable cause, where and when. I'm not sure I understand. I don't think so, because even if there was probable cause, what happened here was not, the entry of the home was illegal. And the fact, what Harris says is you suppress the fruits of the illegal entry. And typically that involves evidence, physical evidence, or other facts that are incriminating. And this is what makes this case a bit unusual, is there wasn't physical evidence that would be suppressed. And Harris talks about things found in the home. What was found in the home here? David Roberson. That's what gets suppressed, the fact that he's in the home. So if you were to find probable cause, Harris says you suppress the fruits of the illegal entry. The fruit here is his presence in his home and the show of identification on the street afterward. The very fact that they rousted every black male in this house of age, from the teenagers up into the mid, I think one man's in his 30s, every one of them was brought out on the porch. There was nothing communicated to the officers who went in the house with any particularity about who it was. They wanted to display all the black males to these undercover cops, keep the undercover cops at a distance, and make the arrest that way.
I'm concerned about the language in the final paragraph of the Harris decision, and that's why I pressed the question with you. where the last paragraph begins, we hold that where the police have probable cause to arrest the suspect, the exclusionary rule does not bar the state's use of a statement made by the defendant outside of his home, even though the statement is taken after an arrest made in the home in violation of Peyton. So in this case, in Harris, they assume an illegal arrest.
Right.
They say you can suppress statements made inside the house,
right,
but you can't suppress statements made outside of the house. Now you have a situation where you have the, arguably, defendant seized illegally inside of the house, but the identification occurs outside of the house.
Right.
Why doesn't Harris control it?
Well, and as I said, if they can show an independent source, if they can show the police would identify them properly, absent the illegal seizure. And this is where the record is so frustrating, because we just don't know what the description was, if any, that they had. The state, in trying to convince the jury that they had the right guy, had the police officers and the undercover officer talking about facial features. But there's no description of what they are. They're just saying they're trained to remember the face for their safety and for the reliability of subsequent identification. But I concede that they may be able to establish an independent source for identification by either Terrell or Wagner or others, but they can't do it with this evidence. They can't do it with the fact that he's in the house and they show up on the street. This court said in DeBose, once you have probable cause for an arrest, you don't do show-ups. So if the state wants to take their argument as a logical conclusion, if they had probable cause to arrest David Roberson, which they didn't, or any of the other males they put in the porch, then they should have taken him downtown, booked him, and stuck him in a lineup.
Why don't they have probable cause to arrest on this record, absent him being found in the house? In other words, setting his location in the house aside. You have Detective Wagner, who observed the defendant, as I recall, prior to the buy. You had Officer Terrell, broad daylight, make the purchase, or be there at the time of the purchase, in just within feet, 4 or 5 feet. And why is it such an impediment, given that circumstance, that we don't have things like age, height, weight? I mean, why can't we infer from that circumstance that there is probable cause? It's not like Bryant, where there was, you know, such vagueness, it seems to me. Here you had an officer that was within 4 or 5 feet that was looking at the guy.
Right. You had probable cause once he was pulled out of his house and displayed them. Yes, once Terrell and Wagner see him and say, that's the guy, that is probable cause for arrest. I don't dispute that for a minute. But how did they get there? They got there by pulling him out of his house without a warrant, which is what the Constitution says you can't do.
So you're saying that the guy that pulled, the officer that pulled him out of the house and brought him in for the ID, that was no... there was no probable cause to pull him out of the house.
On his record, there's absolutely none, because he had absolutely no description of the person he was looking for.
Well, then how did he know it was this guy?
I'm sorry?
Why didn't he?
That's the point. He didn't know. He was, and this, again, the record.
Who identified the first five?
Well,
that they weren't the right ones.
Terrell and Wagner looked at them as they were displayed and said, no, no, no.
The goal here was to just pull out everybody and have Terrell identify.
That appears to be what's happening. Okay. That again goes back to the problem with the record.
Any male, theoretically, any male in that house was being pulled out. They just happened to hit this one.
That's correct.
Who then was identified.
Correct.
So it's the seizure of the defendant in the house that you say was without probable cause and was illegal because there was no warrant to go into the house.
Exactly right.
Could I? Time to get an arrest warrant?
Absolutely there was. And this again goes back, during my 5 minutes later, I'll give you the case law on hot pursuit, but this again goes back to what the police were doing here. They were holding back. They could have called in and gotten a telephone warrant. There's a statute that allows for that.
How could they get a warrant if they didn't have probable cause?
They could get a warrant to search the house for a suspect. They couldn't get a warrant for the arrest of David Roberson. And we don't know what description they gave of, we still don't know what description, if any, Terrell and Wagner had beyond wavy hair, black male, blue jeans, which can describe an awful lot of people in the city of Milwaukee.
But they did have, they could have had an affidavit. They observed the buy. They tracked the people to this house. that therefore there's probable cause to believe that the person who committed the crime was in the house.
Absolutely.
And Terrell might have been able to give a full description. We don't know that.
We don't know that.
Okay. So that, but even if he didn't, that would have been enough probably for a search warrant.
A search warrant, that's exactly right. There was enough here for a search warrant. It's probable to believe that the suspect was still in the home somewhere. They didn't have 100% total constant observation of the suspects from the by till the house. You don't need 100%. You need probable cause. And it's, by the probable cause standard, clearly they had probable cause to believe the person who sold the three-corner cuts was still in that house. And they had enough to get a search warrant.
How did they have probable cause to believe the person who sold the drugs was in the house?
Because, and the record shows this, they maintained sight through various officers who were, there were six people on this redo team placed in different portions of this area, and between them, they maintained virtually continuous sight. There was testimony that during one of the weird turns that was made, one of the officers lost sight of the car for a short time. But they knew the car, they knew the license plate, the car ends up being parked in front of the house with the license plate. They had, with the exception of a few seconds or so here, they had the car and its occupants in more or less continuous sight. They had the house in more or less continuous sight within seconds of the arrival of these two people, and they maintained it within continuous sight for that.
Counselor, just say I agree with everything that you've said so far. Why does that matter when Mr. Roberson was identified by the officers at his trial?
The problem is he was identified at trial, and maybe if they can show an independent source for the identification, he could be identified at a subsequent trial. But the state exploited the fact that he was in his home, perhaps hiding, perhaps not, refusing to come downstairs, whatever. They exploited his presence at his home at a time when the suspect, who I freely concede was probably still in the house, was there. The state used that. They talked about how shortly after the buy this was. They talked about how these officers are trained and how this corroborated what Wagner and Terrell said.
But didn't the officer that identified him at trial, wasn't he specially trained to identify the faces of the people with whom he deals?
That's exactly what he said he was trained to do. He didn't tell us what the facial features were. He just said he recognized his faces.
Okay, and was he one of the officers who was involved in the buy?
Yes.
So whether or not he ever saw him at the house, he had, at least according to his trial testimony, a recollection of what he looked like from being close enough to him to take in his hand the cocaine that he bought, correct?
Absolutely right, although he didn't notice the orange shoes or the orange and green sweater.
He was sitting in a car, so, you know, you might not have seen the shoes if you, someone was sitting in a car. As far as the sweater, he said he had a jacket on, but it was his face, light-complected, wavy hair, jacket with a black stripe on. All of those things were described from the by the officer at the trial.
Right.
So even if there had been a warrant and they took him out of the house with a warrant and nobody saw him at the house, I guess I don't understand why it really matters what happened at the house, as long as his trial testimony was based on his recollection of the man during the course of the buy.
It matters because the fact that Mr. Roberson was in the home corroborated the state's case. This is a case where two defendants were tried. Some of these same trained officers testified under oath, and the prosecutor hammered this point, that Lindsay Edwards was a party to this drug transaction. The jury hung at Lindsay Edwards. These trained officers, despite their training, didn't convince the jury that Lindsay Edwards did the things that they said Lindsay Edwards did. And the jury hung, and the state moved to dismiss. And this is all on the record after trial. This was not the very fact that they don't find any of the drugs. Don't find any, but they always buy money here with pre-recorded serial numbers. They made everybody in this group of black males take the money out of their pants and display it. They didn't find that. The state's whole case rested on identification and his presence in the home at the time when the suspect, I can see, was probably still in the home. That was their case. You're really talking about prejudice, whether this was harmless, whether the fact that he's identified in the home, or I'm sorry, seized in the home, identified in the street after he's rousted from his own home, whether that was prejudicial. First of all, we don't know if they can show an independent source. We don't know if
who has the burden of proof on an independent source?
An independent source, I believe the state does.
Okay. Would you wind up quickly? You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
No, I'll just save my time for rebuttal. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. The issue for this, before this court is whether trial attorney, the trial counsel, rather, was ineffective for not filing a motion to suppress the eyewitness identification made of Mr. Robeson by the officers on the street in front of his home and the eyewitness identification made of Mr. Robeson by those same officers at trial. Mr. Robeson bears the burden of proving that trial counsel performed incompetently for failing to file that motion and that there is a reasonable probability of a different outcome had that motion been filed. I think the discussion so far and the convoluted nature of this case is perhaps the best evidence that counsel did not perform deficiently. A reasonably competent defense attorney might have looked at this case and said, yes, there is probable cause, and yes, New York v. Harris does control, or there is a subsequent in-court identification that would stand up even if the on-the-street encounter does not. More likely, the reasonably competent defense attorney in this case looked at it and said, this search helps me. They didn't find any evidence in the house. One thing a reasonably competent defense attorney could not have argued is what Mr. Martin just argued, which is the identification would be suppressed because the body of Mr. Roberson is a suppressible fruit. It is black letter law, United States v. Cruz, a case relied upon by the court in New York v. Harris, that the defendant is not a suppressible fruit of an illegal home entry in violation of patent or of any illegal search. And that is why we don't have a challenge. You know, counsel argues that there should have been a suppression motion. He doesn't argue that there should have been a motion to suppress the arrest because he knows better. He knows that had trial counsel brought a successful motion to challenge Mr. Roberson's arrest, that because of the probable cause police already had, they could have just turned around and rearrested him on the probable cause because, as it is black letter law in this court, an invalid arrest does not deprive the court of jurisdiction.
Counsel, this is my problem with the case. I start with the premise that my home is my castle under the constitutional protections of the Fourth Amendment. And so in order for police to come into my home without a warrant, you need exceptions. And we have some recognized exceptions. The exceptions that you argue here before this court are consent and exigent circumstances. Now, if I recall correctly, the Court of Appeals said there was no exigent circumstances here. You disagree with that.
I don't know what they mean. I think they said it's something that could be taken up at a hearing if there was a remand. I think they weren't satisfied based on the record developed so far that there were.
Well, let's say there's no exigent circumstance here, just for argument. I know you focus on the possibility of disposing of evidence or being armed, the defendant being armed. And let's say the record reflects that there isn't consent. Let's just say that. You know, it's argued here. So if you didn't have exigent circumstances, and if you didn't have consent, it seems to me, now I'm getting to my problem, it seems to me that what you're left with is someone with probable cause can enter a house without a warrant. And that's a problem. You know, it seems like it's almost a per se rule that you're you have to give me my hypothetical, but if you would. Tell me why that isn't a dangerous per se rule to have all you need is probable cause in order to go into someone's house.
Well, we certainly can go into someone's house strictly on probable cause without a warrant if you have exigent circumstances or hot pursuit of that sort of thing.
You deny
but
hot
the more important thing is what is clear from Rick v. Harris and Peyton v. New York is you, the police officer who does that, who does not have exigent circumstances, who does not, is not acting in hot pursuit, is taking a grave risk, because that officer is assuming, one, that a court will look at the case later on and say, yes, there was probable cause, and two, he's taking the risk that any evidence he finds in that house will be suppressed under New York v. Peyton and New York v. Harris, because those cases stand for the proposition that other than the seizure of the defendant on probable cause, anything else you find in that house, or even any statements you get from the defendant inside that house, cannot be used at trial. So that's, it just doesn't seem to me that an officer who feels he lacks any of the, you know, he cannot satisfy any of the exceptions to the warrant requirement is going to take that risk. That anything he, you know, what if they had found 50 pounds of cocaine in that house? It would not have been used for a trial. They could not have used it. What if Roberson said, all right, you got me, I'm the guy, I sold it to Officer Terrell in his bedroom. That could not be used. So an officer who does that is taking a serious risk, and he would be ill-advised to say, well, you know, we don't have fresh pursuit. She didn't consent. But we're going to go in anyways because I think we have probable cause, or I think a judge will hold down the road that
you know,
we do.
Let's play the odds. What are the odds that they go in there and find $50,000 worth of drugs?
Well, but even if they had just found the $25 buy money, which would have been very helpful evidence in this case, that wouldn't have been admissible.
You did not argue hot pursuit in this court. Only exigent circumstances and consent as exceptions to a warrantless search or exceptions to the requirement for a warrant. Why didn't you argue hot pursuit here?
Well, I just felt that the facts didn't exactly fit because this was a constant surveillance situation. They didn't immediately, you know, Wagner ordered the police to surround the house. There wasn't an immediate bursting into the house. This was, they did try to, I mean, the record is clear, they did try to contact, they knocked on the door, Mrs. Roberson answered, they talked to her, they said, could you have everybody come out? The reason why I thought exigent circumstances fit better is because the exigency was created at that point when she agreed and told everybody to come outside, and they come outside, and Wagner is sitting in front, and he looks and he said, there's five men there, but Roberson's not one of them. And the officers at the doorstep have heard her holler out throughout the house for these people to come out. Now there's someone hiding upstairs in their viewpoint. Now there's a problem. Now there's possible disposal of evidence. And so I think, I thought, and maybe incorrectly so, but I thought this fit better under an exigency situation where the exigency wasn't the moment they set foot on the porch. It was the moment when she complied, ordered everybody out of the house. They came out of the house, and yet Mr. Roberson's not among them. And then she tells them one question, there's conflicting testimony on that point, whether she said, yeah, David's still upstairs with his girlfriend, or I don't know if there's anyone else upstairs. Either way, Wagner just saw him go into the house with his brother. The brother's on the porch, but Roberson is not. And so I think there was the exigency. Now, but you're correct. I did not argue hot pursuit. We relied on the consent. You know, again, we're reviewing this in the posture of a challenge to the effectiveness of trial counsel. And we're reviewing it in the posture of the adequacy of the post-conviction motion. And the post-conviction motion has to make a sufficient showing that it's reasonably probable the suppression motion would have succeeded. And yet the motion contains nothing from Mr. Roberson as to what happened. There's nothing from the two officers who were at the doorstep, Officer Gajewicz and Officer Martinez, the first officers at the door who were then followed by Officer Ward, who did testify. There's nothing from defense counsel as to why he didn't file a suppression motion. And so we argued, and yet there is unequivocal trial testimony from Officer Ward to the effect that there was consent balanced against trial testimony of Mrs. Roberson, which is equivocal on that. It basically a response to a question by the prosecutor. You let the officers in, they went upstairs, they knocked on the door, and they found David. And is that how it happened? And she goes, no.
Mr. O'Brien, it seems to me that you may have a different problem here. You argue to this court that there is probable cause in this case. Now, regardless of whether the court finds consent or finds exigent circumstances, and regardless of whether the court says that the entry into the home was legal or not, once you've argued probable cause, if the court accepts that argument, you now have a show-up that takes place on the street following the finding of probable cause. Given what this court has said in DuBose and the necessity requirement, how do you deal with the necessity requirement for having an on-the-street show-up after this probable cause arrest?
Well, first of all, DuBose doesn't apply here because we're talking about whether counsel at a trial in 2003 should have filed a suppression motion. DuBose was decided last term and reflected, I think, what can only be described as a sea change in Wisconsin law. I think it's unreasonable to ask trial counsel to be clairvoyant on that point. But even if DuBose were to apply, the necessity requirement is met because what was the alternative? Should the police have taken all six of these men into custody and then put them in a lineup for the officers who personally witnessed the transaction? The Wagner who saw everything before and after and Terrell who was actively involved in the transaction, that they were then supposed to go on to
why, take. Why would they have to take the six in custody if they were looking for one in particular and the officer inside had the description of the one?
Well, because I think my understanding is DuBose prefers lineups and or at least photo lineups and the on-the-street encounter is supposedly so highly suggestive that you're better off taking them elsewhere.
As I understood your argument, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, as I understood your argument, the officers had a description of the individual. So it would have seemed to me that you don't need the other five. It's the one that you're focused on. The one that they had the description on is the one that arguably should have the lineup. Why do the other five matter?
Well, but then, all right, maybe not the other five, then maybe you take, well, I mean, then I suppose once Roberson came out of the house, it would have been preferable to take him to the police station and put him in a lineup with four other men who are similar in appearance. But I think that in this situation, that just seems to be unnecessary because we don't, this isn't the case of a citizen informant, a citizen witness who's a victim of a crime who then gives a description. Police find someone several blocks away and bring him back and say, is this the man? These are trained police officers who've witnessed this crime occur, who see the defendant go into the house and then identify him as soon as he's brought out. This is not the identification that creates probable cause. This is a case where probable cause exists, and you're making sure you've got the right guy. I mean, you've got five men on the porch, and the officer. I think a couple of the New York cases that I cited refer to this as a confirmatory identification, where you have probable cause. You bring the person out. The officer who makes the arrest, the officer who saw the crime occur, says, yeah, he's the one out of these five people. Let's take him in. And so this is not the same as the suggestive eyewitness of citizen victim, citizen witness identification, where the police don't know who committed the crime. They're going strictly on the citizen's description. They find the person several blocks away, the person matches the description and bring him back. That's the problem, the problem DuBose was designed to address. It wasn't designed to address this situation where police actually witnessed the crime, and then when there's a group of people on the scene, the officers who actually witnessed the crime tell the other officers, of these people, he's the one to be arrested. I think there's a significant difference there. And I'm just not sure what the alternative is. And let's change the facts a little bit. Instead of Wagner telling Martinez, Gajewicz, and Ward to go up to the house and have these people come out and then say, well, there's Roberson, let's arrest him, had Wagner himself gone up to the house and gone into the house, and had he done what Officer Ward did and found Roberson in the bedroom, we wouldn't have this problem. I mean, we don't have a show-up, and yet we have an identification that's every bit as suggestive, if you will, to that So I just don't think it's the same situation. But I think there was a need here in that there were two things. One, just to separate out the confusion of the situation with all these men around. And secondly, Mr. Martin referred to the fact that Wagner and Terrell were operating undercover. And I think it is a legitimate police concern that the officers involved in the buy can protect their undercover status and that they need not blow their undercover status to make an arrest if it can be avoided. And there were four other cops in the scene who were able to make the arrest. So I just don't see that the boast applies here.
Why didn't the police get a warrant?
Well, according to the trial court and according to Officer Ward's testimony, they didn't need it because Mrs. Roberson consented to let them come in and get everybody out of the house. And, so in their mind, they went up to the house, they knocked, and were allowed in. Now, obviously Mr. Roberson disputes that point, but in their mind, that's what they had here. And they went in and found Mr. Roberson.
I think they probably made the decision not to get a warrant before they allegedly got consent.
I imagine that seems to be a reasonable conclusion. I mean, we are talking about a fast-moving situation here in a very short period of time, however. Sure, a decision might have been made, let's surround the house and let's get a warrant. On the other hand, I don't think it's unreasonable for an officer. Again, they don't know how many people are in the house. They just saw two men run into the house, or at least exit the car, go into the house. And for all they know, there's two people in it. And could they just go up and knock and hope that one of them answers the door and then they've got probable cause and then they've got the culprit right there. On the other hand, there are about eight people in the house or whatever, maybe had they known that in advance, it might have been a wiser move to surround the house. But I think, again, we're talking about a fast-moving situation, and we're talking about the exigency that developed when the people were brought up, when she complied, had them come out, and yet Roberson's not among them, even though he can hear her hollering up the stairs. Now, this gets back to New York v. Harris, of course, which is, in hindsight, you can look and say, boy, maybe these officers should have gotten a warrant. But New York v. Harris says, well, if you have probable cause, and you go in without a warrant, you're going to suffer the consequences of every item of evidentiary value you find in that house. That will not be admissible at trial. However, because the person of the defendant could be seized anywhere, based on your probable cause, we will not suppress his arrest. And as cases have clearly held, we will not suppress his identification either. We will suppress statements, we will suppress drugs, weapons, whatever, but not his identification.
On the probable cause to arrest anywhere, do the police have to know the name of the defendant?
No, I've never seen any case that requires that. And I think it's the observations of the police, the adequacy of the description, and in this case, the collective knowledge. It's one thing, Mr. Martin argued that there wasn't a sufficient description here. It is clear that officers Wagner and Terrell did give radio descriptions to the officers in the area, and it included the description of the man in the gray cutlass wearing a black jacket with a gray stripe and wavy hair. And there's a lot of discussion in the trial testimony about Mr. Roberson's wavy hair, and that was a significant characteristic. And then you have the collective knowledge factor where as long as one officer has the probable cause, he can convey that that request to the other officer. He can, I think the word in the, I used in the brief is correct, he can infuse the other officers on the scene with that probable cause. And they can make the arrest even though those officers individually, had they been acting strictly on their own, would not have had probable cause.
Okay, so when they went into the house, there was probable cause to believe that the suspect was in the house. We agree on that?
Yes.
Okay, so there was probable cause to enter. At what instance was there probable cause to arrest him?
Well, I think there was probable cause to arrest.
Well, you'd have
went to. On, well, went on the doorstep simply because they had probable cause to believe he was in the house.
But he is not unidentified, he, so far.
I'm sorry?
We've got a general description of he, right? We have a description of him.
Well, you have a description of him, but you also have an officer parked in front who saw him.
Okay, so I think the answer to my question is that there was probable cause to arrest Roberson when the officer, the undercover officer, identified him on the street. Before that, the officer who saw him could not identify him from this description, assuming he had it. The only thing is that he was light-colored and wavy hair, but the dress wasn't the same, nothing else was the same. In other words, I'm asking you, could the officer who went into the house have probable cause to arrest Roberson when he saw him in the bedroom?
Well, he certainly had probable cause to seize him based upon the collective knowledge, based upon the radio request of Officer Wagner, the radio description, the fact that Wagner said he observed him go to the house, and the fact that Wagner then said he's still not out here when they brought the other men out, and he's the lone man left in the house.
So the show up really is irrelevant, right? Because there was probable cause to arrest him when he went into the bedroom, when the officer went into the bedroom.
Based on the collective knowledge, yes. And
on the collective knowledge.
Yes, that officer, and I believe it was Officer Ward, who was not one of the two officers involved in the drug buy, but went in at the request of Wagner, that he, based on the collective knowledge he had.
He didn't arrest him, did he? Didn't he just ask him to come outside?
I believe that's right. I think there would be a pretty strong argument that there was a seizure here. And I think the testimony at the trial indicates that he was searched, he was frisked in the hall and that sort of thing. I know counsel makes a repeated argument, well, when was the point of the formal arrest? And I don't think that really matters here. I think what matters here is the point when there was probable cause.
Well, that's why I'm pressing you. So your position, if I understand it, is there was probable cause when this officer entered into that bedroom upstairs, saw this guy, he had probable cause to believe this was the person who the undercover agents had identified. So familiar with the description? Was he familiar with the description? The man?
I believe he was because it was radioed by Wagner.
Okay. We assume that he did that. So that
It's in the testimony. I believe if you look at the testimony of Officers Wagner and Terrell, they both talk about the radio. I believe Wagner originally gave a radio description even before Terrell made the buy. Then Terrell made the buy and radioed a description back.
Did the officer who went upstairs hear the radio?
My understanding is he does. And I know Officer Ward testified, and I believe he refers to the radio description in his testimony. I'm not 100% positive. But if you look at Officer Ward's testimony, I don't know why he wouldn't have, because he was among the officers on the scene who were tuned into this radio channel.
Is the description in the record?
The description of?
The radio description.
I believe Officer Terrell and Wagner both, and I think Wagner's description was at, pages, I think it's document 27, pages 123 and 24, where he read you a description. He's at that point he's talking about the description that Terrell gave him, but this is after his own observations right up in, before that drug deal, where he says Terrell told him that he bought drugs from this two-door vehicle, the gray two-door vehicle with the man with the wavy hair and the gray, black and gray jacket, between 18th and 19th Street in the parking lot, and then seconds later, Wagner saw the car come out onto the 19th Street. And so you have two officers really working in concert here, and between the two of them, they cover every second of this encounter with Mr. Roberson, that Wagner watches the drug dealing activity for 25 minutes in front of this liquor store, then tells Terrell to go and see if he can make a buy. Terrell goes up to Edwards and then is taken to the car. The car then vanishes down the street and disappears for a few minutes, and then a few minutes later, Terrell radios that he just made a drug buy from the car in the parking lot, and then Wagner radios the description, I believe, to the other officers in the area, and then that's when they go to the house. Wagner sees the car in front of the house. So they cover every inch of this, and the other officers in the scene are aware of what's going on.
Mr. O'Brien, I think both parties have acknowledged that because of the absence of really much of a record here, we have a problem with the facts. I mean, we understand that there was no suppression motion filed. We understand that the trial court declined to have a hearing on the post-conviction motion. So I guess my question to you is, given your argument on page 31 of your brief, that you have an independent identification at trial, and not to go to the prejudice problem of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, why shouldn't we just, instead of trying to stretch the facts to try to reach a result, why shouldn't we just rule on this on the basis of the prejudice problem, look at the independent identification at trial, and go home?
Well, that's certainly one option you have, and we've argued that consistently throughout, that you really don't need to get into the niceties of when probable cause attached and when, or whether DuBose applies or any of those sorts of things. I mean, I think Justice Roggensack hit on it too, that I think you can make that determination from this record without an evidentiary hearing, because the close observations by Wagner and Terrell are so strong that the only reasonable conclusion is that the eyewitness identification testimony at trial is independent of the brief show up in front of the house based on Wagner's observations of, when you combine the pre and post deal observations over 30 minutes, and Terrell's personal encounter with Roberson actually exchanging the cocaine and the money while Roberson's seated in the car. So I think, yes, you can this fits neatly into the independent basis. You can throw out the out-of-court identification and still uphold this conviction based upon the independent in-court identification. The other option, of course, is to go under New York v. Harris and say, well, you can go to New York v. Harris and say, even if you have a patent violation, even if they should have gotten a warrant, that Mr. Roberson's not a suppressible fruit in light of United States v. Cruz of that illegal entry, because they had probable cause to arrest him. And therefore, based on that probable cause, that identification could stand up outside the house. But again, you're right. We believe that the conviction can stand based strictly on the in-court testimony, based as it was on the close, continuous observations by Officers Wagner and Terrell of what happened here.
Here's my problem on that. It says that the standard is that the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the in-court ID was based on observations of the defendant at the time of the crime rather than unconstitutional out-of-court ID, right? That's the rule. How does the state do that?
I mean, you were not asked at trial to make that proof, were you?
No. Okay. And that's why the state doesn't have to prove that, meet that burden. No. The burden is, again, on Mr. Roberson to prove a reasonable probability of a different outcome had counsel brought a suppression motion. And he's got to make some sort of a showing that that it would be unreasonable for a trial judge and perhaps the Court of Appeals ultimately down the road to rule that this is independently based. And his motion doesn't offer that. His motion offers nothing other than the fact that there was an on-the-street identification made to argue that there's no independent basis for the in-court identification. And
Mr. O'Brien, were both officers, Terrell and Wagner, part of the show-up?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Wagner initially identified him on the porch, and then Terrell, who was in the back of the house, came around and saw him and you know, identified him as well. And then they both testified in court at trial and identified him as the perpetrator. And I guess one other point I'd like to make about
him. One of the problems I have is you keep saying the defendant and his motion. So you're expecting the defendant to do a lot of detail in that motion because there was no hearing.
Well, I mean, if you're going to allege that counsel is incompetent, prejudicially incompetent, your motion's got to allege something more than he failed to bring a suppression motion. And that's really what we, the bottom line here is he's arguing he failed to bring a suppression motion. And lo and behold, there were in court and out of court identifications made. Therefore, he should have filed a suppression motion. It's not that simple. Your motion has to allege with specificity why it is there's a reasonable probability that the suppression motion would have succeeded here. And in light of the independent source doctrine, in light of New York v. Harris, and in light of the probable cause that existed, he can't meet that. Let's put it this way. It would be reasonable for a trial judge to say that motion is not sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Martin, is your motion, or was the motion good enough here, specific enough?
Absolutely. It was what the motion alleged was that the police entered Mr. Roberson's home without consent, and it alleged that there's evidence in the record and other evidence that I appended to the motion to show that that was without consent and without probable cause. And the most gripping part of this, I don't even remember if I mentioned this in my initial argument, the most gripping part of this is Ms. Roberson's own testimony. I called 911. I called the cops on the cops. People are coming into her home without her consent in a way that they wouldn't, as I said in my reply brief, doing Elm Grove or Maple Bluff. They're coming into her house without her consent, and what does she do? She calls the police. If she had consented to these people coming in, why would she call the police?
Counselor, what is there in the motion that speaks to the lack of an independent foundation for the idea at trial?
I don't think you don't get to that point until the first identification is suppressed. I argue the first identification had to be suppressed. That is something the state has to show if the first identification is suppressed. I didn't argue. That would be several steps down the road. All I have to do to get a hearing, I believe, is to show you've got an illegal search, an illegal entry, a seizure without probable cause, without an exception, and that what happened there should have been suppressed.
You have to show prejudice as well. And if
Absolutely.
There's an independent basis for the identification, even if everything you say is true, you have no prejudice.
But we don't know if there was, because we had this show-up ID on the scene. There was a fruit of this illegal entry. We don't know if these officers really could have picked them out of the lineup.
I know, but I'm going back to your motion again, on which there was no hearing, and I want to know, in regard to that prejudice part, what was said about the independent identification. That's all part of the
right.
same package.
It's part of the package, but my argument is to get that's something that has to be addressed at the hearing. To get the hearing, I have to show that there was a viable claim here that a reasonable attorney should have pursued, and it wasn't. And he speculates as to reasons why the attorney didn't pursue it, but we don't know what the reasons were because I didn't get the hearing.
But even if I assume that I agree with everything you've said, you still don't have prejudice if there's an independent basis, and your obligation when you bring this motion and you expect a hearing is to show enough that if everything you say is true, you'll get the relief you request. And that includes prejudice.
Right. But the prejudice here is, see, I concede that they may be able to show an independent source, but I still believe reversal is required because I don't think this is harmless. The jury heard that he was in the house at the time. The suspect would have been in the house. And I really need to point out one thing. Mr. O'Brien said in the last few minutes that Mr. Roberson was the last person in the house. The record doesn't say that. What it says was he was the last person they took out, and once he was identified, they stopped looking in the house. They specifically testified he didn't search the rest of the house. They never went in the basement. They never went in the attic. What we know is they started taking black nails out, and as soon as they got the one that Wagner and Terrell said that's it, then they stopped searching. So to say he was the last suspect in the house, or the last person in the house, he'd have a real strong case if that was the fact. But we don't know that fact because once they got the man, they stopped. I don't think I'm going to be able to satisfy your question, Justice Robinsack, because my position is a reasonable attorney should have moved to suppress this. The suppression hearing wasn't held. If it had been held, if you could show that this arrest was illegal and the identification was improper, then the burden shifts to the state. You're asking me to defeat a claim that they have to advance after I first met my burden, the arrest and the entry was invalid. And I just don't think you can go that many steps down the road. And I don't think you have to go that many steps down the road to get a hearing. I think you have to show there was a viable claim and it should have been litigated and it wasn't.
Well, I also hear from you that if this had been suppressed, then evidence that was damaging to your client would have been suppressed, and that evidence in and of itself might have raised a reasonable doubt or
absolutely.
The absence of that.
Absolutely.
So even if the second ID was okay, the jury still would have had less evidence upon which to convict your client.
Absolutely correct. Right.
That's
my argument.
An alternative position. Okay.
That's right. There's a couple other points I need to make. Under questioning from the Chief Justice, Mr. O'Brien virtually conceded this was a Terry stop in the house. But the law doesn't recognize Terry stops in the house. My brief talks about this. State versus Rodriguez, it's in my brief. There is no such thing as a Terry stop in the house. Section 968.24, which is the statute that allows for Terry stops, talks about in a public place. We don't have Terry stops, and we don't have Yankee people out of their houses in homes. Terry stops are in public places. And he virtually conceded that the arrest didn't happen until the person was seized from the home and taken outside. I think it's a very important point the court has to keep in mind. Also, the question I fumbled around with Justice Prosser earlier and couldn't address is addressed in this overlong and over-explanatory brief. On page 16, the brief in this court does talk about what hot pursuit is. The state hasn't argued today, but the case law, Welsh versus Wisconsin, of course, a case this court I'm sure remembers, talked about what a hot pursuit is and talks about the suspect being chased from the scene of the crime. And State versus Rodriguez, the case I just cited, which is a 2001 WAAP 206, cites Welsh. This was not hot pursuit. This was the antithesis of it. I see my time is up. I'll just make one last point. Mr. O'Brien argues that the exigency arose when after the people who were summoned were identified, then there's an exigency. This just doesn't make sense. The suspect is upstairs or downstairs or in the attic, and he's not going to start destroying drugs or hiding evidence or flushing things on the toilet until he's called to come downstairs. It's just not what exigent circumstances are. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. That concludes our argument in 03-AP-2802-CR, State v. David J. Roberson. I want to thank both Mr. Martin and Mr. O'Brien, who are frequent arguers here, for their excellent discussion of the issues in this case. One can't usually imagine cases that with fact situations that happen in real life. So we conclude our argument. We will be in recess for a few moments, so those students who wish to leave may leave, and new students may enter the courtroom.